This episode of The Edge is brought to you by Audible.com, your source for the best audiobooks, including unabridged readings of the latest novels from the incredible family of Star Trek authors. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help this show and the network at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
TFM. What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?
Welcome, everyone, to The Edge for Star Trek Discovery Season 3. I'm your host, C. Brian Jones, or Chris, if you like, and I'm excited to explore the 32nd century with you. If you're a longtime listener of The Edge, you know that in the past we've had an array of sub-shows. In addition to this main show, we had Live from The Edge, Postcards from The Edge, Tracks from The Edge, and for Season 1, Notes from The Edge, which I hosted. As I mentioned last time, we're streamlining things this season, and I'll be bringing you this main show as our coverage of Star Trek Discovery. Myself, it's my solo take on what's unfolding on the TV show. It will largely follow the format of notes, but I'd love to receive your feedback for postcards, which I will incorporate into this show. For those of you who enjoy Mike and Max's commentary tracks, be sure to subscribe to them over on their website, filmdamagepod.com, where they are doing commentaries for this season as part of their Holodeck Techs podcast. And of course, you can find that podcast in your favorite apps as well. And if you prefer group discussions, there are countless Discovery podcasts that follow that format, so you can enjoy those in addition to my solo take for kind of a wide-ranging commentary and take and discussion of Star Trek Discovery Season 3. Before we get going, I should point out that although I am releasing this podcast late, actually quite late, due to work deadlines and People of Earth, the third episode has already aired, I prepared my thoughts before seeing People of Earth. Work kept me completely tied up through to the weekend after People of Earth aired, and then I escaped for 4 days to the mountains and hot springs for a desperately needed break and to mark my birthday, which was November 2nd. And then that was followed by a series of annual work events. So there were very few breaks. And I do apologize for not keeping up with the broadcast schedule that's on CBS All Access, but I also needed to manage my mental health, as I think most of us do in this crazy year of 2020 that we're in. So anyway, what I'm sharing here are my views of how the season is unfolding in real time as I watch it, which means I don't know what happens in People of Earth as I prepare this podcast. You may know something from the third and even fourth episode already as you listen to this, but I don't have that information as I write and record. So I just want to make that clear right up front. Okay, let's put on our cowboy hat and go. And the first thing I want to talk about is the fact that the original series has Spectre of the Gun, and the Next Generation has a Fistful of Datas, and Enterprise has North Star. Plus, the NX-01, famous for its movie nights, carried a slew of westerns in its film library. There was Apache Serenade, Band in Phoenix, Beyond the Rocky Mountains, Canyon of the Rustler, Death in Arizona, Escape from Dodge City, Frontier Maverick of the West, Montana Ambush, Sheriff's Revenge, and The Stagecoach of Flame. Of course, none of these are real, although that last one sounds like Data trying to add Chariots of Fire to his Netflix queue. Now Discovery can be added to the list of Star Trek series that have featured Western-themed episodes. Far From Home may not be quite as aesthetically on the nose as those other three. But make no mistake, there's a new sheriff, or two, in town, Giorgio and Saru. Speaking of which, let's talk about what an amazing captain Saru is. I'm pretty sure, although I'd have to go back and confirm, that I said on Notes from the Edge at the end of season one that I hoped Saru would be the captain in season two. That was before we realized the impact Pike would have on the series, and because of that and the incredible job that Anson Mount did with the character, I'm glad that Pike was the captain. But for sure, I saw great potential in Saru as a leader. And those feelings continued for me in season two, despite Saru being largely sidelined by Pike. When Discovery set sail for the future at the end of Such Sweet Sorrow, I certainly hoped that Saru would take the lead in season three. For the moment, he has, and with flying colors. First of all, Saru is very well written. Secondly, Doug Jones's performance is among the best in Star Trek, period. Week after week, I am blown away by what he does with this character and through extreme prosthetics. And I don't mean week by week right now. I mean going all the way back to the Vulcan Hello, to the very beginning of Discovery. Just every week, Doug Jones knocks it out of the park for me. We're seeing at the start of this season that Saru embodies the Starfleet ideals that many of us grew up with, and in many cases, certainly in mine, influenced us to become the people who we are today. He is old school Roddenberry, and that's an important point of contrast in a series that is very much written through modern eyes. And I'll come back to this later. Sticking with Saru's leadership in this episode, he provides the steady hand that you would want and need in such a situation, and he does so with compassion, assertiveness, and confidence that you expect from the best leaders.
Status reports. Tactical systems are down.
As are long-range comms and all in-ship communications, Commander.
Sensors are not responding. We don't know where we are, and we don't know when we are, sir.
We can't fly.
We can't call for help. We can't call Michael.
She's alone.
We are completely disconnected at present, yes. But we are also together and alive. If Commander Burnham landed elsewhere, I trust she is aware that we will find her as soon as we are able. Begin a search for the affected relays and conduits. Inform all you come in contact with to do the same. Crew members are to work in pairs until internal communications are reestablished.
Commander, we can't locate the problems without internal sensors.
I can modify the tricorders, like I did on the Hiawatha.
I will survey the damage in person. And I am aware that you all may feel an expedited need to see and understand what is out there. But our first priority is in here, the integrity of this ship and this crew. Am I clear?
Aye, sir. Aye, sir.
Lieutenant Reese, you have the con. Ensign with me.
While it may not be the most exciting part of the episode, Saru's handling of the situation is one of the greatest parts of Far From Home. He remains calm under pressure, thinks quickly, is organized, and doesn't back down. Although he is always willing to listen to his crew. And he doesn't put up with Giorgio's crap either.
You! Did I hear you say we still have no communications?
He will complete repairs as soon as he is able, Commander. All available hands are busy repairing the EPS grid. Do you require medical attention?
Of course not. We can spare one engineer.
I have no desire to leave Commander Burnham on her own. But we must get all systems up and running as quickly as possible. Wherever we have arrived, we are strangers. We cannot assume that we are welcome. Carry on, Mr. Bryce.
Yes, sir.
I'll come back to this as well, because my thoughts aren't as flippant as they may seem right here. Before I leave Saru, however, I want to talk about how nurturing he is. those who listen to Notes from the Edge for season one, or The Ready Room, which is my other podcast that I host with Larry Nemechek, know that I'm not a big fan of Tilly. Although I think Mary Wiseman does a fantastic job of portraying the character, and I certainly understand why she's very popular with many people, she just hasn't connected with me, really. I've warmed up to the character some, but I'm not there yet. In this episode, though, she's clearly shaken by the experience that they have been through, as many of us no doubt would be, whether we were an ensign or a lieutenant or a commander. I think it's very understandable to be shaken a bit by what they've been through. And Saru senses that. He says that she is a good first impression, but I don't think that is his only reason for choosing her to accompany him when they leave the ship. I think he knows that she needs a steady hand and a compassionate hand, and he comforts and nurtures her.
Sorry, sir, I'm talking because I'm scared.
I know. Keep talking, Ensign.
You know, on the ship I said the scans were odd or strange, but it's not true. We're odd and strange.
Not to each other.
Thank you for asking me to accompany you, sir. Why did you ask me to accompany you, sir?
I needed an engineer.
The ship's full of engineers. Giorgio's an engineer.
An engineer I can trust.
She thinks I'm useless.
She's concerned for Michael and lacks the self-awareness to control her behavior in such an unsettled state. We are introducing ourselves to the future. You, Ensign Tilly, are a wonderful first impression.
I really loved this whole sequence. Saru is Starfleet. He is Jean's vision. And I'm so glad we have him in the series. And I'm so glad that Doug Jones is playing him. Okay, before we get too far away from my comment about Giorgio's crap, let me expand on that. I find the contrast between her and Saru in this episode to be important commentary on the situation we find ourselves in today in the real world, and also on the debate between past and present Star Trek. As I just said, Saru is Starfleet. He is Jean's vision. Saru represents the ideal world that Star Trek portrayed, or at least pursued, for so long. He is unwilling to betray his principles, even as they are challenged, whether by forces beyond his control or by individuals with personal agendas and a disregard for norms. He summed up Giorgio quite well when talking to Tilly. But that's only one side of the story. On the other side is Giorgio, who represents the screw it, I'll do what I want mentality that has been eroding society for some years now. It's not that this way of thinking is new, but the normalization of it threatens the stability of our world. Put that in a microcosm within Star Trek, and you have a battle between sticking to Gene Roddenberry's vision and casting it aside because things get tough. Now, I'm not here to say that one view is right and the other is wrong. As many listeners know, my favorite Star Trek series is the one that deals with shades of gray, Deep Space Nine. And that is largely because I don't think the world and life is as simple as Gene Roddenberry's framing of it suggests. Given the choice between Saru's approach and Giorgio's, however, certainly I'm Team Saru.
They have 930 years on us. Why hide from them?
Assuming we arrived in the correct time, we carry with us a knowledge of certain past events that we cannot share, lest we impact the present or future of any society with which we interact. Whether or not the local population is more or less advanced is immaterial. We will adhere to their cultural standards. We will barter peacefully.
We crash landed, and we're going in blind. Trust they greet us peacefully? Preposterously low.
We will not abandon what we believe.
If this were my planet, I'd already have surrounded weapons drawn.
I am not asking you to participate, Commander. I am telling you what we will do in your absence.
What do you call pain? I call foreplay.
Giorgio, you will not harm him further. That is an order.
Killing him would be a service to the galaxy. Even you can't deny that.
This is not who we are.
It is who I am.
Commander Giorgio, give me your weapon.
Move out of my way.
This degree of violence is completely without justification.
If not for me, you'd both be dead. And he'd be taking our dilithium as we speak.
I am truly sorry we could not save him. We will send more than enough dilithium for you to reach the exchange Cal mentioned and repair your mining equipment. And we will leave you his vessel. But it's not our place to decide his fate. It is yours. We have done enough damage here, and we humbly apologize.
But what I find interesting here is the question of whether sticking to a rule book and oath of non-interference at all times is really a path to success. While many fans see Discovery as throwing out the Star Trek formula in favor of generic sci-fi action and TV drama, I see it more as questioning whether a somewhat antiquated view of reality is sustainable. And I see that as a reflection of real-world attitudes fueled by a culture of toxic individualism and rage fueled by social media, as well as the death of objective commentary and respectful discourse. And I think we see that play out even within the context of Star Trek discussion every day in social media. And it reflects the larger interaction and discourse that we have on so many topics in our own world. Maybe I'm going too deep into the woods here, but I really feel this vibe in the exchange between Saru and Giorgio, and it makes what is unfolding so far in season 3 more interesting for me than what Discovery has done until now. Whether it is intentional on the part of the writers, I don't know. Before we leave Giorgio, I found this line interesting as well.
What the hell are you doing here besides saving their asses?
Saving your ass? You're welcome.
I don't do gratitude. You could have stayed on the Enterprise and remained in the time you were meant to be in if you believe in that kind of thing, which I don't.
Stayed for Arium. She's a science officer, but she paid the price of a soldier. Felt like someone should honor that. A life for a life, you know?
I do. What an unbelievably shitty decision.
Says the woman who's still here.
Section 31 would have begged me to take over sooner or later, and bureaucracy is where fun goes to die. I like jumping from universe to universe.
Ever since the end of season 2, I've been wondering how they are going to get her back to the 23rd century so that she can lead the Section 31 series that they are preparing. Now I'm wondering when and where that series will be set. Her statement opens up many possibilities. I can see a Section 31 series set in the 32nd century, in an alternate universe or an alternate timeline, or jumping around. If you ask me today what I think is most likely, I'd say that the Discovery crew will somehow reset the timeline so that this post-burn future never comes to be. And they will return to the 23rd century as part of that. Or at least some of them will. But I'm not sure yet. The next thing I want to talk about is the bridge crew and the extended crew, such as Jet Reno. Oh, Discovery writers, please tell me you aren't just teasing me again like you did in the second episode of season 2 when you tricked me into thinking that you were going to develop the crew and give them things to do, only to hide them away for the rest of the season so that not even Linus with his 74,000 nanometer visual spectrum could find their character development? I hope not. With respect to the many characters on Discovery, Far From Home was exactly what I have been longing for. Owasakun, Detmer, Bryce, Reese, Nahn, Reno, Culber, Stamets, Linus, Nilsson, even Hazmat, I mean Jean, had real moments in this episode.
Commander, internal comms are back up and running. We are good to go.
All crew, this is Commander Saru. Stations, please.
Tactical is still offline.
Our sensors at 73%.
External comms still reinitializing. 3 minutes until ready.
Shields back in 3 minutes as well. Other operational systems online, not at full functionality just yet, but we'll be all right.
Let's not forget, Owosakun is the operations officer. That's the same position filled by Data on The Next Generation and Kim on Voyager. Detmer is the helmsman, the same position filled by Sulu on the original series and Paris on Voyager. And Bryce is the communications officer, the same position filled by Uhura on the original series and Hoshi on Enterprise. We deserve to know them. They aren't just window dressing. Far From Home brought all these characters and more to life. I really do hope they continue this. But with the entrance of Michael Burnham in the next episode, I fear that all these wonderful characters are going to get lost again. Call me cynical, but if there's one thing that two seasons of Star Trek Discovery has shown me, it's that everything comes back to Michael Burnham. And yes, some fans point to Kirk and Picard in an attempt to say that this is nothing new, or to push back when someone like me says that there's too much focus on Michael Burnham in the storytelling of Discovery. But it's not the same thing, and you know it. Discovery needs to break out of its all roads lead to Burnham mentality if it wants to tell the best possible stories and realize its potential. I have nothing against the character, and Sonequa Martin-Green does a phenomenal job portraying Burnham. Really, I think she's fantastic. And not because we share an alma mater. But I want to know more about the other characters. I want to watch an ensemble cast, not just in one episode, but across a season and a series. More than ever in Star Trek, you have to try harder to write compelling characters and to help us get to know them. You have 13, 14, 15 episodes to work with now, not 26. Let's make Far From Home the norm, not the exception. All right, Bobcat? Jet Reno, by the way, may be the star of this episode. After Saru, no one had more impact on me than her, especially this line.
Helpless is a shitty feeling, but it is not forever, and it doesn't make you any less capable. Do us both a favor and just admit that you're not bringing your A game.
That line actually really was important to me because this has been, and I know I'm not alone here at all. Many of you have had the same experience, I'm sure, certainly since March, but this year has been extraordinarily difficult. So many things have come crashing down, and it's been a real struggle to get through the year. And there have been times when I felt like I maybe can't do it. But I've managed to make my way through, and I'm starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel on various things. And, you know, just feeling that way, when Reno delivered this line in this episode, it just instantly connected with me. And when the episode was over, despite everything that happened along the way, yeah, that was one of the singular moments that stuck with me. And Jet's also quite entertaining. She's easily one of my favorite characters in Star Trek, and Tig Notaro, one of my favorite people.
Why are you talking to me as if we're working on this together?
Because that's exactly what's happening.
Absolutely not.
Saru wants us working on teams, and apparently if you can breathe, you can work. So unless Hazmat over here is going to be helping after he cleans up aisle 5.
My name is Gene, actually.
I've already forgotten that.
Did I do it?
you did.
You? Thanks. Jet? Thanks for nothing.
Back at you, Bobcat.
Bobcat?
I don't know. I'm on drugs.
Now, the big mystery so far, apart from the obvious questions about the burn and what happened to the Federation, seems to be what is happening to Detmer. I don't have any real idea yet, but I suspect that it has something to do with the tidal forces inside the wormhole interacting with her ocular and cranial implants. She does take a hard fall, but Dr. Pollard tells her that she has no concussion, so I don't think the fall is the cause. I also don't think it is a simple matter of her feeling disoriented, even though that's largely how it's being portrayed right now. They've already played it up too much for it not to tie into some bigger plot point eventually. It could be that she is slightly out of phase with the rest of the crew, or she senses echoes of other time periods. I don't know, many things could be going on, but this is another case of the writer's failure to develop their characters, causing setups to fall short. It would be more interesting for us as viewers if we could speculate based on what we know about the character. But we know very little about Detmer. We know that she was injured at some point between Battle at the Binary Stars and Context is for Kings, the second and third episodes of season one, and as a result, we assume, she required ocular and cranial implants as part of her recovery, but we don't know how she was injured. That's not really important, so it's fine, but what is important is the purpose of those implants. How do they function? What is the silver brace on the side of her head? Why does she need it? How does it help her? These are all questions that I have, but we have no answers to. Let's just, as an example, lift this plot point of Detmer walking around in a daze and drop it into the next generation. Suppose this were Geordi being affected. We started learning about his visor and how it functions early in the pilot episode, Encounter at Farpoint.
Naturally, I've heard of your case. The visor appliance you wear is...
is a remarkable piece of bioelectronic engineering by which I, quote, see much of the EM spectrum, ranging from simple heat and infrared through radio waves, etc., etc., and forgive me if I've said and listened to this 1,000 times before.
You've been blind all your life?
Mm-hmm. I was born this way.
And you felt pain all the years that you've used this?
They say it's because I use my natural sensors in different ways.
Well, I see two choices. The first is painkillers.
Which would affect how this works.
Mm-hmm.
No. And choice number two?
Exploratory surgery. Desensitize the brain areas troubling you.
Same difference. No, thank you, Doctor.
And throughout the series, we learn more and more about the visor. We're shown how it functions and see Geordi at times struggle with side effects. Because we have some idea of what the visor is, we could speculate how tidal forces from a wormhole might affect it and in turn Geordi. That's just one example. Others include Data's positronic brain, Troy's empathic powers, Jadzia's symbiont, Seven's implants. All these were addressed early and then built upon. Detmer's implants have been like decorations. I'd really like to see more attention given to her and other characters so that we actually get to know them. You can't tell rich and rewarding stories if you don't have a deep bench of players. All right, so maybe this was more a continuation of my plea for character development than a thought about what is happening to Detmer. Sorry about that. I went down the rabbit hole. But I'm curious, and if we go back to the plot, obviously, something is happening beyond being dazed. I have a feeling it will be key to how the story unfolds, to some element of the story that fits into the larger outcome, but I don't have enough information to really speculate. It feels a lot like the Arium situation from season two, where she became key to the plot, but having completely failed to develop her or even give her more than a few seconds of screen time here and there since the start of the series, the writers had nothing to cash in, so the whole emotional plea fell flat. I imagine some of you will hear this as anti-Discovery criticism. It's not. If I didn't like Discovery, I wouldn't spend hours and hours of my very limited time creating this podcast about it. Believe me, this takes a lot of time. I just want the series to realize its potential, and to do that, I think characters such as Arium and Detmer have to be more than background players. Okay, so enough of my rant about character development. I have a few more quick observations before delving into the notes section, and one is that Far From Home has a bit of a classic Star Trek standalone episode feel to it, just as New Eden did last time around. This hit me right away. I mean, first viewing, even before I got to the end, I'm like, it kind of reminds me of New Eden. And like New Eden, it's the second episode of the season. Also like New Eden, it gives us hope, as I was just saying, that the bridge crew is going to get more involved. That didn't pan out last season, but hopefully it will this time. I found it curious, the second episode of these two seasons both have this sort of standalone feel where they do tie into the bigger story, but you could watch it without knowing anything else and kind of really enjoy it the way that you did classic Star Trek episodes. It was also great to see Culber and Stamets back together, both as themselves, as we remember them from season one, at least mostly themselves. Stamets is injured right now. I think he will be back to normal in the next episode, recovered from being impaled at the end of last season. I am glad that they carried that forward and he wasn't already better. I mean, naturally, he can't be because they just jumped through the wormhole, but you know, it is one of those things that can be overlooked in the writing. So I'm glad that they carried that forward the way they did and they gave us some real continuity here. But I think he'll be better in the next episode, and we'll pick up with the relationship between Culber and Stamets as it was growing before Culber's death. The process of getting him back last season was really one of the highlights of the whole season for me. I thought it was handled in a very interesting and a very touching way, and so I'm really looking forward to seeing where their story goes. And beyond the characters, there's one more question. Far From Home Part 2. The question about the title remains. And I still see people talking about it and asking questions as if they just now realized that there is no Part 2 listed. Some people, understandably, have even thought that Netflix in their country missed an episode. It's a strange move, for sure, but I'm confident that the unresolved matter is part of some creative plan for storytelling. So I've been thinking about what that might mean. Could the episode eventually fill in the blanks of what happened during Michael's year-long search for Discovery? Could it be a Short Treks episode to come after the season? That would be quite odd, I think, as these are separate series, if you will. But it's certainly possible. We are getting some crossovers between Short Treks and mainstream Discovery storytelling. And there is also the possibility that it's a 14th episode to be tacked on at the end as part of a surprise announcement by CBS that they're giving us one more episode. Or it could be the premiere of season 4. Also possible we'll never get a part 2. But I think it's in there somewhere. Speaking of Short Treks, as we move into the notes section, we finally got that connection between Calypso, its setting, and Discovery's jump to the future. It's really quite clever and suggests that the writer's plan to jump to the 32nd century goes back further than we thought. The connection, which a lot of us have been digging for now for quite a long time, and we can finally see it, is the term Vedresh. In Calypso, Kraft arrives on Discovery aboard a Vedresh escape pod, which he had stolen.
Your wounds were pulse burns. You had a suit of heavy blast armor and a well-stocked weapons rack.
You're a soldier.
A reluctant one.
And a crafty one?
I have my moments.
Like when you stole an escape pod from your enemy? I scanned the pod's media log. It was equipped with a library of 542,000 media files. You watched one of them 811 times, suggesting them.
I couldn't figure out how to turn it off. The Dresh, they prize things like that. Relics from the long ago. It's torture.
The Dresh, those are your enemies?
I mean, what is Betty Boop?
It's hard to explain.
But you know, because you're from the long ago, too. How long you been out here, alone, waiting for the crew to return from wherever they went?
Almost 1,000 years.
This exchange between Zora and Kraft is more revealing in light of Far From Home. When we first saw Calypso, and Zora said she had been waiting almost 1,000 years, I think most of us took it to mean that the story was set in roughly the 32nd or 33rd century. But now, it could be read as being closer to the 42nd century. We know that the ship is currently crewed in the 32nd century, and after repair is in pretty good condition. So if it has been almost 1,000 years since the crew abandoned the ship, that would put us a millennium out still when we see this stuff happening in Calypso, and she says 1,000 years. Of course, it is entirely possible that more time travel will be involved. The ship will be abandoned back in the 23rd century, and Calypso is indeed set around the same time as where we currently are in season 3. Or, given the time variables they're already playing with, Michael arriving a year before Discovery, despite the ship being right behind her, they might abandon the ship in 3189. Confusing, right? Kraft's comments about the Vedresh make me feel more like this is the 32nd century, not the 42nd. Certainly, I don't think they had much of a plan at that point when they produced Calypso for very specific connections. And I think the reference to 1,000 was meant to be from Discovery's present, meaning the 23rd century. So likely it's around the same time as what we're watching now. But I'm not sure how it fits together. Maybe it's a further split in the timeline. But anyway, this is just something that struck me as I was rewatching Calypso to check in on the Vedresh connection. And then I just started thinking, like, wait a minute. What does she mean 1,000 years? And yet he's using the term Vedresh, which seems to be from the 32nd century. And really, that's what's important here. Who are the Vedresh? It seems clear from Far From Home that they are what remains of the Federation.
We shaving here, die ahead, quackering here, Opay together.
Te being time thicker, Te having Xerthos. Is he bigger free up to getting?
We will get further using the common tongue.
Any captain with some miles on him, even a Vedresh captain with no pigeon. Are you new? I should offer my congratulations. The thing is, you got no authority here.
Did I interrupt a critical moment of diplomacy?
A one-woman tactical response. Vedresh has officially reached its nadir.
A fancy vocabulary doesn't mean you're scary. It means you have a thesaurus.
In Calypso, it seemed like Kraft was perhaps talking about an alien force. Although Kraft was from the planet Alcor 4, he was human. So it was easy to imagine that he was part of the Federation, and he was fighting against the Vedresh. But now, it definitely appears that the Vedresh are the Federation. So he was fighting against the Federation, and yet he's human. So that's interesting. The escape pod he stole used Federation Standard, or English, for its interfaces, and he pulled up old media, including Betty Boop cartoons and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Michael Chabon, who wrote Calypso, confirmed on Instagram back in 2018 that Vedresh is a syncope for Federation. A syncope is a linguistic distortion resulting from the loss of sounds or letters. The original Greek word from which the English comes literally means cutting up. There's a famous science fiction story by C.M. Kornbluth entitled The Luckiest Man in Denv, which employs this concept, Denv being short for Denver. The story was published in 1952 in the magazine Galaxy Science Fiction, and I ran across it sometime in the 1990s when I was reading an anthology called The Road to Science Fiction Volume 4, From Here to Forever, which was edited by James Gunn. And the story is set in the far future against the backdrop of a war between Denver and Los Angeles. And at that time, Denver is known as Denv, and Los Angeles is known as LA, spelled E-L-L-A-Y. The syncope concept is also employed in John W. Campbell Jr.'s 1934 short story, Twilight, which was published in Astounding Stories and is one of my favorite science fiction short stories. The central character is a time traveler from the year 3059, which stood out to me when I was thinking about it just because of the time setting here between Discovery Season 3, 3189, and he's from 3059. But he meets a local person on Earth in the 1930s, because that's when the story was written, and he's talking about time travel. And in the process, he talks about how language shifts over time, because he actually had jumped to the far future, even beyond the 31st century, where he was from. And he talks about how language shifts over time and syncopes emerge. So as soon as this Vidraish thing came up, the gears in my head started turning, because it's an idea, you know, that I've come across in a number of other stories related to science fiction. So anyway, I don't know how much was already planned in terms of Vidraish as a name for the Federation and the setting of this season of Discovery, but it does seem that thought was already in motion when Calypso was written, because at least Chabon himself had made that connection more than 2 years ago and shared it publicly, that Vidraish is a syncope for Federation. But I'm glad to see that the connection between Calypso and some other part of Discovery is not as simple as it first appeared. I thought this was quite nice. Let's move on to an element mentioned in this episode that first appeared long ago in Star Trek, in the original series episode Patterns of Force, which aired in February of 1968. In Far From Home, Bryce references this element, which is Rubendium, when talking to Saru.
How long to repair this, Bryce?
Well, it's not a repair, sir. This particular transtator, it's a complete rebuild. 6 hours minimum, assuming we have enough rubendium.
A key point is that Bryce is repairing a transtator in an effort to restore communications. In Patterns of Force, McCoy embeds subcutaneous emergency transponders into the arms of Kirk and Spock so that they can still be found should their communicators be taken or no longer work.
We must get our communicators. Contact the ship.
I point out, Captain, the flaw in the plan is this locked door and the guard beyond it. To the logical mind, the outlook is somewhat gloomy.
The transponders.
Yes.
And a way to shed some light on the gloom, Mr. Spock.
Of course. The rubendium crystals in the transponders.
You're the thickest computer, Mr. Spock.
Yes, it would be necessary to hold the crystals rigidly at a specific distance, which I believe should be 27.2 millimeters. Now, rubendium crystals should find enough power here to achieve a necessary stimulus.
The transponders used rubendium to function. So from the very start, rubendium has been tied to communications. It's a bit of a deep cut, though, as the element has not been referenced very much on screen or in the literature. Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens mention it in their 1990 original series novel, The Prime Directive, and David R. George III does so in his 2006 TOS novel, The Fire and the Rose, which was the second in the Crucible trilogy that was published to mark the 40th anniversary of TOS. This book focused on Spock, while the first centered on McCoy, and the third on Kirk. Beyond that, rubendium is included in the Starfleet Medical Reference Manual, which was published way back in 1977, which was authored by Jeffrey Mandel and illustrated by Doug Drexler and Anthony Frederickson. And also, it was included in the 1987 FASA role-playing game module Starfleet Intelligence Manual. But that's it. So there's not a lot of use of rubendium, but the way they've used it in this episode is, it's the way it was used before. You know, they've found it, they've referenced it, and they've tied it to communications. So a nice little deep cut connection there. As for transstaters, that's one of those tech things that as fans, we feel like we hear often, but transstaters aren't mentioned all that often, and most references come in later series. The Deep Space Nine writers mention transstaters in Trials and Tribulations, in The Cards, Rejoined, The Siege of AR-558, and Prodigal Daughter. The Voyager writers do so in Time and Again, and Future's End, and Trip Tucker mentions it in the Enterprise episode Dead Stop.
Honestly, I started to feel a little sorry for the Doctor. It wasn't anything for him to do, stand there and watch this thing work.
You know how he must have felt? I saw an entire transstator assembly replaced in 15 minutes. It would have taken my crew a week. With this kind of technology, Starfleet could build ships that maintain themselves.
In the Litverse, transstators appear in Prime Directive, which I mentioned already, and in one of the original series numbered novels from 1993, Mel Gilden's The Starship Trap, which is TOS number 64. But that's it for rubendium. The last connection I'll talk about is maybe the first that really stood out to me, and it's the unexpected but appropriate race that turns up on the planet known as the Colony.
My name is Cal. I told you.
They can't help us, Cal.
Yes, they can. And they will. It's a part of them. How they are.
Friends, our navigation system is damaged. What planet are we on?
It's never had a proper name. We call our home the Colony. We're miners, many of us Corridan.
While the reference may have passed by in the heat of the moment for many viewers, longtime Star Trek fans will remember that the Corridans, or Corridanites, as they're sometimes called, were involved in the talks to form the Coalition of Planets, which then led to the United Federation of Planets. And the first mention of them, or at least their homeworld, goes all the way back to 1967 and Journey to Babel, during the second season of the original series. Corridan was seeking admission into the Federation at that time. Perhaps more importantly, however, Corridan was one of the primary sources of dilithium as far back as the 22nd century, and probably long before that, because they were already supplying the Vulcans when humans first encountered them. And that's why the choice to make Cal and many of the miners Corridans in a story that centers on dilithium is so appropriate. This is the second time the Star Trek writers have dipped into the deep well of past stories to bring back this little-known but important Federation member race. Enterprise did so midway through its first season in Shadows of Pajim, when Archer and the NX-01 visit the Corridan system in a story that also involves dilithium shipments.
I noticed we changed course overnight.
I found a new system in the Vulcan database. Corridan. They're only a few light years away, so I thought we'd take a look.
Inhabited?
Just over 3 billion humanoids. Apparently, the Vulcans have a mining agreement with them. I had Hoshi send a message to their chancellor, and she invited us to visit their capital city.
I'll start shining my boots.
The series references Corridan again in its second season in the episode Kanemar, and then in the final season in Demons, which is the episode that features the Coalition of Planets, TOX. We also get mention of the Corridon system on Deep Space Nine in One Little Ship, again in relation to dilithium mining.
We have restored impulse power, and the warp drive will be operational in 5 hours.
Excellent. It's good to see my faith in you has not been misplaced. The Founders will be pleased. If you require no more assistance, I will resume our mission to Corridon. Let's hope the Federation's dilithium miners will be as surprised to see us as a Defiance crew was.
Victory is life.
Indeed.
And in the episode In the Cards...
Something wrong, Eminence?
No, nothing wrong, but there was a shop down there, as I recall, a woman who sold Bajoran tapestries and antiques.
Ah, Kandra Vilk.
Yes.
I believe she moved to a neutral world near the Corridon system about 2 months ago.
And, of course, there is a reference on TNG in the episode Sarek, given the title character's role in the Babel Conference. But it is Enterprise where we actually see Corridons, so that is the reference point for considering what Discovery has done to bring them back to screen. And my initial reaction to the makeup was, here we go with yet another remake that is a bit too far off to connect with what has been established. Or remember, I talked about the Beetlejuicians on the last episode of The Edge. But after going back and rewatching Shadows of Pajim, which is the first time we actually saw this race, I have to say that the Discovery artists have done a really nice job of updating the makeup for the ultra-high-resolution 4K age. I honestly did not remember very well how they looked on Enterprise, which I imagine is true for most viewers, so the deviation is really not an issue at all. And once you compare them and you see that it is an obvious progression of what came before, I think it works really quite well. I should point out that the Corridon delegate to the Coalition of Planets, Talks, and Demons wears some sort of mask, which some people have considered a full remake of the makeup within that series. But I've always seen it as just like a ceremonial mask that they wear. And underneath, they look the same as they did in Shadows of Pajim. That's just been my interpretation of that difference in the Corridons that we see on Enterprise. And last point, just to be thorough, Discovery did reference Corridon in Season 1, sort of. You need to have a sharp eye, but you can spot it on the star charts in Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad and The War Without the War Within, as we learn that the Corridon system was occupied by the Klingons during the war. So there was an on-screen reference, even though we didn't see any Corridons and it was just on a star chart. All right, that's my rundown of the second episode of Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Far From Home. I'm sorry that it took me so long to get it put together and out to you, but I do hope you enjoyed the ramblings, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on the episode. I realize you'll have to mentally roll back a little bit because there's already been a couple of other episodes of Discovery air, but if you can do that and you're interested, I'd love to hear from you. As I mentioned at the beginning, I will incorporate postcards into this show as comments come in. I haven't done so for this episode as I wanted to get this all put together and out to you, but I will gather them for a future one. So please share your thoughts and questions. There are three ways you can do that. You can go to the Babel Conference, that's our listeners group on Facebook, and add your thoughts, comments, and questions to the post for this episode of The Edge. So when I publish this, I'll put the artwork for this episode up there, synopsis, all the information, and then if you can just comment on that post, share your thoughts, share your questions, and you know, mark it as four postcards. That'll help me as well. I'd like to gather some comments that way. You can also send an email if you prefer. To do that, you can go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form that you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose The Edge, and that will come straight to me. And then the other thing you could do, especially if your thought is shorter, is to just hit me up on Twitter. You can tweet the network account, that's at TrekFM, or directly to me personally at C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's my username pretty much everywhere, C. Brian Jones. But Twitter is where I'm most active. I'm always up for thoughtful discussion of Star Trek, be it Discovery or any series or books or comics or whatever you want to talk about. So go ahead and hit me up there on Twitter. If you'd like to hear more of my thoughts on Star Trek at large, you can find me on my main show, The Ready Room, which I mentioned at one point today, I believe. I do that show with Larry Nemechek. That's a 10-year-old podcast, so there are a lot of episodes and a lot of topics that have been covered on there. You can also find me on The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast, which I do with Matthew Rushing. And then Matthew and I also host Literary Treks, which is our books and comics podcast. Not only can you explore the Litverse through that show, the way I talk about it here, on The Edge, you can also hear firsthand from the authors, as we have the great pleasure of talking to almost all the active Star Trek authors as their new novels are released for a behind-the-scenes look at the writing process. I also have a fairly new Star Trek Universe podcast called Interphase. I have a few episodes of that out now. I'm exploring all corners of the franchise through that show, and I'm trying to do some topics that are a little bit different than what I've done in the past. So check that out if you're interested. You can find these and all of our Trek FM podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much everywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for the name of the show that you like, search for the network, search for the master feed. Many ways for you to get the audio onto your device. Lastly, if you'd like to help us keep The Edge and all the shows on our network going, we could definitely use your help. The coronavirus pandemic has taken its toll on us, as it has so many people, and everyone's had to reallocate resources. That's completely understandable. It's hit us quite hard. It takes a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows, and any support you can provide is most appreciated. If you'd like to help, please visit patreon.com to find out how. That's patreon.com. We have various perks, including the ability to become an associate producer of your favorite shows and to get involved in the Patrons Roundtable, where you can hop on mic with fellow listeners and some of our hosts to discuss Star Trek, just as we do on our podcasts. And we publish that on our website, of course, and also in our master feed for everyone to hear. So it's a great way to take part and, you know, get to know us. And often, you know, those paths have led to more involvement in the network and even on mic. So if you're interested in Star Trek discussion, I would love to hear from you in that respect. And I want to thank our associate producers of The Edge, speaking of Patreon, James Muldrow and Cornelia Rotner. And I hope others will come aboard to help us keep Star Trek discussion alive. Thank you to all our patrons for your support. We really could not do this without you. All right, it's time for me to start preparing not only for the next installment of Discovery's 32nd Century Adventure, but I need to catch up on episodes of The Edge. I need to do the one for People of Earth. I need to do one for Forget Me Not. And I'm going to try my best to get back in sync with the broadcast schedule. I can do it if I race, but I really want to make these episodes in depth because it's evergreen content. People are going to listen to it years from now. That's certainly been true of our other podcasts. So I am putting a bit more time in to make them in depth. It does take me a little longer to get them out. Do apologize for that, but I'm going to catch up. So that's what I'm going to be doing. I hope that you all enjoy your week and you've got another episode of Discovery coming up in just maybe 4 or 5 days from when I'm wrapping up, you know, by the time I get this out to you. So anyway, enjoy the week, take care of yourselves, stay healthy, and I'll see you next time as we rebuild the Federation.